some thought that it may have a fiscal impact. That apparently has been clarified. There is no fiscal impact, at least above the threshold required to send the bill to Ways and Means. The committee, we have Sam Sears here, who's staffing the committee today with Mr. Bill Joseph. Sam is a Willamette Law School student, apparently quite a bright one, so we'll test his threshold of tolerance here with my inept questions. And then there's one other announcement that I've buried here. On Monday, there's a Dr. Ed Latessa criminal justice presentation, 8 to 10 on Monday. Says he's a nationally recognized leader in research in the criminal justice system, National Institute of Corrections, and cooperates with our own Department of Corrections to sponsor the visit. So that ought to be interesting, and we'll have some discussion and dialogue about some of the things they say. Senator Ferriello.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I have a guest LA, a shadow today from Baker City, Beverly Calder, a former city councilor and president of the Downtown Association. And like many citizens, she's come to the Judiciary Committee to ask why there's no justice in state government. So we'll try to answer that question.
Well, Baker City is a wonderful little city. The Grand Geyser Hotel is a nice place. I've stayed there. And the food's good, too. So.
Yeah, that whole downtown is...
Yeah, it's nice.
So historic.
So historic.
Are we ready to rock and roll here, guys? Okay. Anybody else with any questions, concerns, diatribes, political speech? None? Okay, I think we're going to start with Senate Bill 64. And, Mr. Sears, you want to give us an overview of what this bill does?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 64 was submitted at the request of the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee. It does a lot of different things. I've summarized them on the SMS, and I'll briefly state. This bill limits the heirs that are able to take a share of this of an estate when an individual dies without a will, and amends the law in order to solve some practical problems that the division of state lands encounters while administering estates, and it makes changes in order to clearly define the authority of the division of state lands to administer estates. I believe there are some people here, or a person here that will be testifying.
Do we have the sign-up sheets? I know Mr. Darris is here on this bill, I believe. All right. So I called the last person first. The last will be first, the first will be last.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name's Warren Darris. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland. I've been a member of the Oregon Bar since 1971. About 4 or 5 years ago, I signed a contract with the Department of Justice under which I began representing the Division of State Lands in escheat probates. An area of law that very few attorneys experience in their practices, even those of us whose practices focus on estate planning and probate. In fact, a month ago I mailed a draft of the bill to the chairman of the estate planning and administration section of the bar, Chris Klein, and last week I called him and asked him if he'd had an opportunity to read it and if the section would have any input on the legislation. I once served as legislative chair for that section, and I know they certainly follow the bills of importance in probate. And Chris's response was, you know, well, nobody else in the bar really knows anything about escheat, so I don't know that we have anybody that wants to appear on this matter. And although they certainly are aware of the hearing today because I let them know about the scheduling, no one from the bar has appeared. I've also distributed drafts of the bill among academics, the law school professors at Willamette and Lewis and Clark who teach probate for their review and input. My experience working at the or with the Division of State Lands, which administers escheat estates, for the last 4 years has been that much of what they do doesn't really have authority from the legislature, and some of the authority they have really needs to be clarified in a number of respects. In many respects, they operate under administrative rules for which a questioning lawyer might legitimately question the authority for the rule. And one purpose of this measure, of this bill, is to incorporate into statute many practices that already exist. I have brought with me, and each of you should have a packet containing five items. The first is the outline of my testimony, and I want to relieve you all by saying I don't plan to read this. This is more of an outline. The second is a background paper on Eschi in Oregon. The third item is a copy of the bill, Senate Bill 64, as I would like to see it, because Senate Bill 64 is still a work in progress. Unfortunately, given the timing, we didn't have enough exchange between the Legislative Council's office and myself, and what you see is Senate Bill 64 is the first draft of that came out of Legislative Council. I submitted a number of comments and corrections to that draft. There are errors in it that clearly need to be corrected before this measure can be finalized. And I am working with Legislative Council and the staff in order to assure that those corrections are made. The last two items are a memorandum explaining point by point the problems with the existing bill that need to be corrected, and a red line comparison of the Senate Bill 64 with my proposed corrections so that you can see word by word where I think corrections are needed. What I would like to do in my testimony today is focus on the basic concepts that we are trying to implement with Senate Bill 64.
I was wondering if perhaps we could get the Oregon State Bar to allow attorneys to get some credit for the presentation.
CLE credit? Actually, I once did get CLE credit for doing this kind of work.
Yeah. And actually, keep in mind you're talking to, for the most part, a group of non-lawyers. Senator Ring, of course, is a practicing attorney. But I don't believe you practice in this area. So we probably all benefit by at least some of the foundational.
And what I want to do is, I was driving down here thinking about what I'm going to say today. I realized that my testimony as outlined really begins with the cures for the problem without really explaining the context of the problem. So I'm going to begin by doing that and not begin off the prepared testimony. Under the Oregon Constitution, Eschi property goes to the Common School Fund. But the Constitution does not define what Eschi property is. That is up to the Legislative Assembly. The basic concept is this. When someone dies, they can control the disposition of their estate, subject to the tax laws, of course. Many people, most people, do that with a will by the time they die. If they do not execute a will, Oregon law, ORS Chapter 112, says where their property goes under rules governing intestacy. Intestacy is dying without a will. Generally, if you have a spouse, your estate goes to your spouse. If you have no spouse but children, your estate goes to your children. If you have no spouse and no issue, no descendants, your estate goes to your parents, or if they are not living, to the descendants of your parents. If you have no living parents, no living descendants of your parents, your estate goes to your grandparents or the descendants of your grandparents. And those are the kinds of estates working for the Division of State Lands that I deal with the most. Those who die with no immediate family, and so we are searching for descendants of grandparents. Before 1969, when the current probate code was adopted, there was a strong favor given in the law, strong preference given in the law to blood relatives to the exclusion of escheat. If you couldn't find a descendant of grandparents, you would go to great-grandparents and look for descendants of those. If you couldn't find descendants of great-grandparents, you would go to great-great-grandparents and look for descendants of those. California law still provides that. In 1969, the broad-based committee looking at revision of the probate code looked at that situation and decided this doesn't make any sense in modern America. People don't know, don't have any contact with the descendants of their great-grandparents. Many of them don't have contact with the descendants of their grandparents. In fact, in my administration, working for the Division of State, in my experience working for the Division of State Lands, you'd be amazed how many people have no contact with their children, their siblings, their nieces, their nephews. So in 1969, we narrowed heirship in Oregon so that it only extends to descendants of grandparents. Now, you might think that for the average person, when you think of your family, you say, I know who my grandparents were. I know all my aunts and uncles. I know my cousins, or I know most of my cousins. The estates that we deal with at the Division of State Lands are those of people who are totally separated from that family, who have no record when we go into their home after they've died, have no record of who their family is. And those estates, if no relatives are found within the scope of heirship under Chapter 112, those estates will escheat and become part of the Common School Fund. I can tell you this, under present Oregon law, escheat is extremely rare. We usually confine descendants of grandparents, even when we are dealing with decedents who died in their 80s, whose grandparents were born in the middle of the 19th century, and who died in the early 20th century without any contact for many years with the decedent.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Thank you. I just have some questions about this. Essentially, by removing the decedents or descendants of the grandparents, You're moving cousins out of the picture of who can take by a sheet. Is that right?
Usually that's the generation that's left. It'd be cousins or cousins once removed, the descendants
right.
of deceased cousins.
And the way it is right now is that if somebody dies without a will and they don't have any closer relatives, their assets would go to the cousin, and you don't want it to go to the cousin. You want it to go to the state.
That's correct. If
Mr. Chair, just my comment is I'd rather go to the cousin. That's just my...
Yeah, if the person is over a threshold age, in other words,
okay.
if the person is old enough to have had ample opportunity to have made a will, but I do want you to keep in mind that is only one section of this rather lengthy bill.
I understand, but it's... I guess I'm just telling you it's a section I don't agree with, but
I appreciate you stating your biases before we actually have the entire presentation. That's good. It gives me something to work with.
Well, when we have 12 points on what the bill does, I decided to start at least with one of the first ones. So go ahead. I'll wait for the other 11.
Sure. While we're on that issue, let me tell you my experience dealing with those cases, because a good deal of what I do is not pure practice of law. A good deal of what the Division of State Lands does in administering these cases is searching for those cousins. And I have had the experience of contacting cousins to tell them that they are entitled to inherit something, usually from someone they don't know and have never heard of. That's frequently the kind of relationship we are talking about. And the question before the committee with regard to Section 1 of the bill is really this. With respect to those distant relatives, and I can say in my family, I haven't a clue to who most of my cousins are. And if you knew something about my family tree, you'd understand why. But for many people in modern America, it is like that. The cousins are strangers. And the older the decedent is, the more likely it is that the cousins will be strangers. And given that environment, if you take the choice between the common school fund and the stranger, I'm inclined to lean towards the common school fund. There are certainly modifications that could be made to the bill to relieve Senator Ringo's concern over the fact that, yeah, there probably for many people will be some cousins who are known to the decedent. We could impose a requirement similar to that used in wrongful death cases for allocation of wrongful death proceeds, that in order to take, a cousin would have to show that there has been some loss of society and companionship, so that we could actually distinguish between those who have a relationship, those cousins who have a relationship, and those who don't. And I have drafted a revision of Senate one, or of Section 1, that would accomplish that. That would be a significant departure from the existing principles of heirship law, however, that ordinarily you don't have to prove a relationship, that it automatically depends upon the blood relationship.
Mr. Darris, Senator Walker has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Darris, our able intern and counsel, acting counsel today, put in our summary that they call these distant cousins and relatives laughing heirs.
That's the colloquial reference that
because
you get to these folks.
They laugh when you call them up and say, did you know that you're entitled to share in the estate of your long-lost deceased relative?
Let me tell you this. The study, there's actually a Law Review article that I brought with me that discusses that at some length. And my experience conforms to what I read in that study. They are not truly laughing heirs. Most of them feel kind of guilty that they're getting something they know they don't deserve. They certainly take it. I mean, let me give you no doubt about that. They certainly take it. But I haven't heard anybody, you know, really laugh out loud. I've heard people surprised and grateful. I once called... had a file hit my desk, and it took me about 45 minutes to locate the fellow's nephew in California. And after going through the conversation and verifying with him the information I knew about the family, that he was in fact a nephew, and getting him to outline. And of course, this one wouldn't have been affected by the will or by the bill because he was a nephew, not a cousin. After explaining to him who I was and what I was about, and verifying that he was in fact a nephew, and finding out from him that the only other heir would have been his sister, I told him, your uncle, who he described as the uncle that had left town after World War II and nobody had ever heard from him again, your uncle has died here in Oregon, and you and your sister are each now $250,000 richer, tax-free. This was right before Christmas, and boy, was this his Christmas present for the year.
Now, could I ask a question, Mr. Chair? Thank you. Why was that tax-free?
Because the death tax threshold in Oregon is $600,000 for Oregon purposes and $1 million for federal purposes.
That's right. Thank you. I just went through this with my father-in-law's death, and I should have known that. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions before...
Mr. Chair. Senator
Ringo.
Sir, excuse me. I know this is asking for generalization, but what type of sums are we talking about? Are most of them less than $50,000, more than Is there
if I have a list of estates in which I have been personally involved in my testimony on page 7 at the top. The largest, the Zednik estate, which is a Washington County estate, is $6 million. I can tell you a little bit about the Zednik estate. Three sisters lived on a farmed on a hillside south of Portland that happened to be called Bull Mountain. None of them ever married. Each of them had a will. This is not a case where there were no wills. Frequently we see problems with defective wills. Each will left the entire estate to the other two sisters. They died, all three of them, within 2 years of each other. When the last one died, very large estate. It goes by intestacy because the will is now totally ineffective, having named two predeceased sisters. The estate is divided half to cousins in the United States and half to cousins in Czechoslovakia. Needless to say, these were not the closest of family members. These are distant relatives of people who in fact did wills, and in completing their wills, they didn't care enough about these cousins to provide for them.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ringo.
I mean, these are examples of the largest estates.
Mm-hmm.
They're not representative.
No. These are the ones that I have dealt with. Some of them are, as you can see from the dollar amounts, smaller. We get a number of insolvent estates.
Right. Or
that we administer.
$5,000,
$10,000. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. But usually when you get a real small estate, these are the ones I've dealt with. The small estates, the Division of State Lands deals with internally.
I see.
The estate coordinator, Natalia Ion, who is the one in the front line dealing with those, is here and available for the committee today, although that might be a surprise to her.
Just before you get started, I want to ask a question. We've had Supreme Court justices in front of us talking about the issues that were in the minds of the founders of this state when the Constitution was originally written. Do you have any understanding or history of this particular constitutional amendment and what the founders might have thought they were doing in terms of putting this money into the Commons Rule Fund, or what they might have expected in doing so?
I have not researched that issue. The concept of escheat has always been around historically through the Middle Ages. At one time everything reverted to the king when someone died, and then the king redistributed it among his vassals appropriately. Over the years, the concept of heirs having a right to inherit grew by legislation. The law in Oregon is absolutely clear that the right to inherit without a will, or even with the will, is entirely within the control of the legislature.
I just think it's interesting that the founders were foresightful enough to say we want this money to go into the Commons School Fund.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't say the general operation or general fund of the government. They said the Commons School Fund.
And certainly one good policy reason for that, which you can see in this list of estates, is this is not money that you can depend upon. In some years, you get a $6 million estate like the Zednik estate. In others, you'll get very little. And under intestacy law, as it has existed in Oregon since the 1840s, there was, until 1969, a very clear preference for blood relatives, no matter how remote. So escheat has been, in fact, very rare. It is not the principal source of income for the Common School Fund. I think if you look at the numbers of dollars in the Common School Fund, and I know this was an issue recently because of the discussions of using Common School Funds to plug budget holes, the total amount that is accumulated in the Common School Fund over the history of Oregon is left from escheat is actually less than the amount that has gone in there from unclaimed property, which is an entirely different category of funds. You know, the bank accounts where the depositor is lost and so forth, an entirely different category of funds that go into the common school fund. So it makes sense to preserve consistency in the budget. You never know if a Howard Hughes is going to come along and die in Oregon with no heirs. It makes sense to preserve consistency in the budget that that should not be a part of the year-to-year budget. Otherwise, you have the same problem that you do that Oregon now has with capital gains. Capital gains are very irregular, and it creates a big budget problem when capital gains drop dramatically. So,
well, we've got through section one of the bill, I think, so far. Right?
Okay. So let me now launch into my outline of testimony on the various issues other than just section one that this measure addresses. And keep in mind, if you will, that the bill before you is a work in progress. It is as much my fault, certainly, as anyone else's that this got to Legislative Council as late as it did, so that we didn't have the opportunity to do the kind of exchange back and forth that I would like to see in order to make the bill something closer to the revised draft that I have presented to you. There are a lot of technical flaws in the bill as printed. I'm not going to get into those one by one. There is a memo that addresses those, and I'll work them out with Legislative Council. What I want to do with the committee, and I assume that's what the committee wants, is to deal with the broad principles that we're trying to implement in this measure. Right now, Oregon law says that if somebody dies with no will and no known heirs, the director of the Division of State Lands can be appointed or should be appointed as personal representative, or in smaller estates can file a small estate affidavit, and no one else can do that. Practice is that when we receive notice, when a medical examiner or a funeral director calls in Italia and says, we're dealing with somebody who died and we can't find any record of family, the police have gone into the home and they can't find any record, we can't find a will, this is your baby. What the Division of State Lands does is governed not by statute but by Oregon administrative rules, for which the legal authority is questionable. But in any event, what they do is an estate coordinator or estate administrator from the division goes to the home and they conduct a search. They are looking for records of family. They are looking for a will. They also take preliminary steps to protect the assets. If there's money sitting out there, and I know one case in which the estate administrator went in and there was $45,000 in cash in the home. Okay. By the way, always two of them go out, so they watch over each other. Steps are taken to protect the property. The cash, the obvious movable values are removed. They're either put in storage, they're put in the vault at the Division of State Lands, or cash is deposited in an account. Arrangements are made to pay for the funeral. The Division of State Lands actually has no authority to dispose of human remains, but they have authority under the rules to tell the funeral director how much they're willing to pay to dispose of human remains. Others have authority to direct disposition of the remains. So this period of initial review, initial search of the records may last a week or two or three. During that time period, the Division of State Lands can run up substantial costs. They can have my time looking for heirs. We, in some cases, hire heirship search firms, but usually not until later in the process. Ultimately, if we find heirs, we ask them to reimburse those costs. Right now, there is no statutory authority for us to recover those costs. And one of the things the bill does is give the statutory authority for what the Division of State Lands is in fact now doing.
Senator Walker has a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Darris, I have a question about reimbursement for costs and those sorts of things. First of all, you can't direct how the body is to be disposed of. You can direct how much you pay for that. So my question would be, do you direct to have that done most inexpensively as possible, such as a cremation? And then secondly, when you find the heirs and ask them to reimburse the costs, wouldn't that just come out of the estate assets?
That's correct. The reimbursement that we seek is only out of estate assets. We do not ask anyone to pay Division of State Lands expenses out of their own funds.
Okay, so then you're in possession of the assets, so before you distribute them to the heirs, you would deduct the cost of the investigation and then disposal of the remains and those sorts of things before you distributed the assets?
We have no authority to do that. We distribute all of the assets, and then we ask them to reimburse us.
Oh, you just ask them, and they may or may not?
Usually they do.
But
I mean, let me tell you, that fellow I called in California was very, very willing to reimburse the $110 or so that we billed him for my time.
But my question is, you don't.
But sometimes
require,
they don't.
You don't require them to.
I send a form letter to them, referring to the administrative rule under which we're supposed to recover our costs. I don't mention that there's no real statutory authority for that administrative rule, and most of the time they reimburse us.
Okay.
Most of the time they are grateful for what we have done.
So in this...
But I do have one open right now in which we incurred, and Natalia, I'm sure, could talk at length about the day and a half the staff spent in a rodent-infested home before they came across the list of the four children and their Social Security numbers that allowed me to track down where one of them was.
Okay.
We had $3,000 in costs in that one, and they're refusing to pay it.
So in this bill, we would require them to pay?
Yes.
Very good. All right. Thank you.
Okay. So we would not only give actual legal authority for us to go in there and do what we're now doing, but we would also create very specific authority for reimbursement to the actual costs incurred by Division of State Lands. We don't make a profit off this.
Right.
We just don't think we should be losing taxpayer money
for
an activity that is really for the benefit of the heirs that we locate. And most of the time, this is the point at which we find heirs. I remember the old Larry Larimer, who was the estate administrator for years and years and years. He used to tell me, you know, his techniques for doing this, which were well refined over the years. He would go in there, and if he found a phone book, you know, the personal phone book, he didn't come back to the office and run up Division of State Lands dime. He sat there on their phone and made all the long-distance telephone calls until he ran down the heirs. So a lot of techniques have developed over the years for dealing with these. But many times, you know, the rodent-infested home that I was talking about, many times there is just no easy way to do it. And it does cost a lot of money. And what our interest is at the Division of State Lands is to protect the interest of the Common School Fund by administrative rule, pre-probate, and under the probate code. Once you file the probate, however, we are obligated to search for heirs, and it is appropriate that we do that. The legislature has defined by heirship in Chapter 112 who is entitled to these estates, and we do make every effort that's reasonable under the circumstance to locate those who are entitled to inherit. Right now, the Division of State Lands can only serve as personal representative if there is no effective will and if there is no known heir. What that means in practical terms is this. We get into the house, we start searching, and we find a record of one cousin. And, you know, the family trees that we work with scatter all over the place. It's rare for an estate to actually go to one cousin. Usually one cousin may get a tenth share or a 20th share. If we find one cousin, our legal authority ends. We have absolutely no power to do anything once we find an heir. Even though the shares of missing heirs, if they are never found before administration is complete, would escheat. We have no ability to protect the interest of the common school fund other than trying to monitor what the heir is doing. The bill would change that to allow, not require, but permit the Division of State Lands to continue administering estates when there are missing heirs, even if some heirs are found. The practicalities of the situation are that many of the estates we deal with are relatively small. And frequently when we find an heir who we expect to be entitled to a relatively small portion of a small estate, they are not interested in pursuing it. I have an estate open now in which the only asset is some undeveloped real property worth maybe $30,000. You know, out in the far hinterlands of East Multnomah County where nobody really cares to go.
Yeah. That would be my district.
We located two heirs. You know, and from the information I can see in the family tree, there may be 15 or 20. Neither of these two live in Oregon. And I can't get them to do anything. I've, you know, written them letters, repeatedly requested, you know, please go ahead and administer this estate. This is just sitting there waiting for you. You're going to inherit something, not very much. But, of course, you're going to have the duty to protect the creditors. You're going to have the duty to search for all your distant cousins who are also heirs of this estate. And, of course, also the cousins on the other side. You know, you're on the maternal side. You're also going to have to figure out who the cousins are on the paternal side. And they just have no interest in doing it. And we can't do it, which makes it hard for us. You know, and of course the letter that I sent to them said, oh, by the way, we have $567.36 in costs in on this, and please reimburse us for that when you administer this estate. They're just not interested. I've got another estate that I just got where I prepared all the papers to file probate, sent them to Salem, and that weekend I discovered two cousins who live in Washington. One of them's in his 70s and one of them's in his 80s. It's not a, you know, it's a decent sized estate, but not terribly large, and there are going to be a lot of heirs. They're not very interested in doing anything. So we need that authority for two reasons.
Senator Walker has a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Durris, I find this totally fascinating. I wish I had taken this class at some point in my life, but. So you're saying there currently is no timeline for the heirs. So you find one, you send them a letter, and there's no timeline for them to administer the estate. So it could just sit there in perpetuity until they someday decide to administer it. And you would like a timeline so that if they're not going to administer, then it becomes a sheep.
Well, no, we're not asking for a timeline. We're asking for authority for the division to do it. As long as there are missing heirs, we're asking for the Division of State Lands to have the same rights as those who are missing to step forward and administer the estates. if those that we have found are simply not interested in doing
But what you're saying, though, is you're not usurping the interest of the heir that's been identified.
No.
You're just going to administer the estate to the extent that the law would have required this person to have done.
The bill as written would give the division the same rights as the missing heirs. If the missing heirs have equal right to administer with the known heirs, in some cases we may find it appropriate for the division to administer the estate. Let me give you an example of one we've got open now, where after we filed the probate, we found two cousins, brother and sister. The brother considers his sister a crook for the way she handled their father's estate when he died. The sister accuses the brother of stealing assets out of the father's estate when he died. We're not really enthusiastic about getting into the middle of that or turning the estate, most of which belongs to other people, whom we haven't found yet, turning the estate over to two people, each of whom accuses the other of being a crook. So in that estate, I might be inclined to recommend that we continue to administer until we found all the heirs and maybe find somebody in that case who's geographically closer than those two people, both of whom are out of state.
Senator, hang on just a second. Senator Walker, will you finish?
Well, I actually, no. I had a further follow-up question. Thank you. Because I'm sitting here thinking, what you really want here is the money to come into the common school fund. So if you find an heir, and the heir doesn't want to administer the estate, why would you want to find any more heirs? Because I would just say if they don't want to administer the estate, they have a certain time period to do that, and if they don't, it just reverts to you and the common school fund.
It doesn't have that effect. Of an heir can wait a week, a month, a year, 10 years to administer an estate. The heir's share still belongs to the heir. Some cases, we will get an estate that we know is solvent, that there is some net worth for the common school fund. And we'll get heirs who express no interest in administering it. And I will provide them assignments to assign their interest to the common school fund. Or disclaimer forms so that they can release their interest and the other heirs or their children will receive those shares.
But my question is, why let an heir have the opportunity to administer an estate over a 10-year period? Just say you have 2 years or 3 years from this date to administer this estate. If you do not do so and show that you are completing administration, because sometimes it's hard to complete them in that period of time, but if they're actively doing it, but if they're not doing anything about it and it's just sitting there and doing nothing, then I think it should revert back to the DSL and into the common school fund. So why should you go find more heirs?
The problem is, outside of the context in which we're dealing, this very isolated area of probate where estates can escheat, it is not at all unusual for estates to be administered years after the person dies. You may have a situation where there was a single child who inherits the family home, and they don't see any need to probate their parents' estate. They know they're the only one that's going to inherit anything, and so they don't. They'll live in the family. You know, the tax bill's going to come in the parents' name every year, and they pay it. And 5 years later, 10 years later, they want to sell the home, and they can't give clear title without doing the probate. And so a probate can occur many years after a death, the usual motive being to clear title to real property. And that would certainly raise the interest of the bar estate planning and administration section if we were going to put some kind of a time limit on doing a probate.
I'm done.
I had a question, and that is, once you find an heir, for the estate, doesn't it become clear at that point that the estate is not going to the school common school fund?
No, because not only can the whole estate escheat when there are no heirs, but Oregon law enacted in 1969, which was a dramatic change from prior law, provides that the shares of missing heirs or devisees also escheat.
Oh, I see. So if there are 20 heirs and you can only find 10 of them, the 10 get, each of them gets a 20th, and then the common school fund gets half?
Yeah, well, there's a formula for determining the shares. It's not quite that simple. It basically depends on the generation in which they live. Those in lower generations take the share of their deceased ancestor. But in any event, it's divided in accordance with a formula and the common school fund. And I've administered estates in which I've not represented the Division of State Lands, representing private clients, in which I've been unable to find somebody, and we'll send a check to the common school fund at the end.
Okay, so if one of the heir gets a bigger share and they cannot be found, then a bigger share goes to the common school fund than if it were a more distant heir.
Correct.
So the Department of State Lands does have an interest. The way this question came about was, it seemed to me from your comments that once you find an heir, you're out of the...
Yeah, and that's the problem. We have no authority once we find one heir,
right,
other than to monitor what they do, if they do anything.
So what your argument is as long as the common school fund stands to gain any part of the estate, that they have an interest and want to be able to take the responsibility to administer.
Yeah. Two things, really. First, yes, that's the real legal basis for our authority to act in these situations, is to protect the interest of the common school fund.
That's what I wanted to clarify. Senator Rigo, did you have a question?
But let me just add to that. De facto, the Division of State Lands has become the agency because there is no other that steps in as an interim party to take care of estates when you can't, during that period while you're looking for somebody. There simply isn't another body in the state of Oregon with authority to do that, to take care of property in which nobody has a great interest.
I think that's become abundantly clear. Continue on.
Yes, Vice Chair, I have a question.
Oh, Council has a question.
What happens when DSL administers an estate, part of or the share of an unidentified heir escheats to this common school fund, and then one of those heirs comes forward and says, I understand from my long-lost cousin that he or she inherited something and that I'm entitled to something?
Okay. Right now, when we go through a full probate, at the end of the probate, an order of escheat is entered. Or if there was an estate administered by someone else and there was simply an heir missing, 30 days after the decree of distribution, if they still cannot find that person, an order of escheat is entered with respect to that individual share. From that date till 10 years after, the heir can come forward and file an administrative proceeding in the Division of State Lands and recover that share. And that is, that procedure is set forth in Chapter 116, and the bill does propose some significant changes to that procedure. We don't want to leave probate estates open forever while we wait for these people to come forward. And so one of the important provisions of the 1969 Code was to remove it from the court at some point and make it an administrative process to distribute those shares for people who come forward late. Another issue, by the way, with regard to this question of partial escheats or not finding all the heirs is this. Not only can we not initiate a probate when we have one heir and 10 missing, when we begin a probate and subsequently find an heir, the director of the Division of Estate Lands resigns, even if not all the heirs have been found. Again, the statutory basis of our ability to administer estates is that there is no effective will and that there are no known heirs. And it doesn't make any difference whether we find an heir before we start probate or after we've started probate. Once we find an heir, we're out of there. And it's up to the heir to administer the estate. Next issue, and I'm down to number 5 on page 2 of my outline, is notice to the Division of Estate Lands in partial escheat estates. Under present law, when an heir administers an estate and they know, you know, the brother disappeared umpteen years ago and they haven't heard from him since, and he's entitled to a share and they haven't a clue to where he is, and that a share ultimately will escheat if he's not found, they don't have to notify us. We have no ability to protect the interest of the common school fund in those cases. The first notice in a situation like that that is legally required to be given to the Division of State Lands is not even at the point of filing the final account. We don't get notice until 30 days after a decree of distribution has been entered, which is the earliest point at which an order of escheat might be entered with respect to that share. The bill would require, again, put the Division of State Lands in the shoes of any heirs that are missing so that we could get notice of those estates and at least monitor what's going on, get a copy of the final account, and if, you know, it looks like improper expenditures were made or the estate was not properly administered, have an opportunity to object at a reasonable stage in the process. It's probably very rare that we would, but at least we keep a record of what's going on with those kinds of estates. The sixth point, allow the director of the Division of State Lands to designate estate administrators to act as fiduciaries. Right now, the statute requires that the director of the Division of State Lands, Ann Haines, be appointed as personal representative for escheat estates. That means, in fact, of course, all the work is done by the estate coordinator, the estate administrator, and their supervisor. But all the paperwork has to be signed by Ann. What point 6 proposes, what the bill does, is make the Division of State Lands more like a bank trust department. You know, when a bank is appointed personal representative, when a trust department is appointed personal representative, the court order specifies the bank or the trust department. It doesn't say a person who happens to work there right now. What we deal with right now is, because the statute specifies the director, some counties insist on putting Ann's name on the order and on the letters of administration that are issued to the personal representative.
Hey, excuse me for a second. I hate to interrupt. In the nick of time, I was going to invent some rules to deal with this.
Actually, what you can do is simply form a subcommittee.
Recess. Recess and then reconvene.
Yeah.
You can move
again.
I'm sorry.
That works.
Sorry. We've got a forum problem.
So all this is a relatively simple administrative change, which would allow the director to designate subordinates to be estate administrators, comparable to bank trust officers, who could then sign documents, sign the petitions. There's a lot of paperwork that needs to be signed in a probate proceeding, and it's simply not practical particularly if we enlarge the scope of airship, as this bill proposes, of course. It's not practical to have the director signing all these things, and it's really not appropriate to force her to have to sign all these things that she personally doesn't really know much about. She's got a fairly large operation there to administer, and this is not her primary activity. Point 7, allow the Division of State Lands not to serve as personal representative for insolvent estates. Our interest, again, is to protect the interest of the Common School Fund. Right now, the statute in Chapter 112 provides that when there's no will and no known heirs, only the director of the Division of State Lands can serve as personal representative. And that is true even if the estate is insolvent and no portion of it will go to the common school funds. It is appropriate in those cases that the director be allowed to step aside after investigating the assets, deciding the estate's insolvent, and let the creditors, who are the only ones with a real interest in the estate, administer it. Interestingly, the small estate law, which I helped rewrite in the 1989 session, allows the director to step aside in favor of creditors for small estates. But the general probate law does not do that, and we propose that the director have the ability to step aside and allow someone else who really has an interest in the estate to serve. You know, the objective of this bill is not to enlarge the domain of the Division of State Lands. It's to arrange a more rational arrangement for administering estates in which the Division of State Lands has some interest. Point 8, regulate compensation for heirship search firms. If you work in a probate court in a large county in Oregon, you are accustomed to the fact that every day an agent for an heirship search firm will be there looking to investigate every probate file that was filed the prior day. They're looking for estates in which heirs or devisees are identified but missing. They're looking for estates that are going to cousins in which there is a possibility of missing heirs. They have a nationwide network. There are many of these firms, none based in Oregon, several based in Utah, one in California, one in Pennsylvania, that are very active in Oregon. They have a nationwide network for tracking down heirs. They are very efficient at doing that, particularly with the information now available on the Internet. When they find an heir, they will go to them and say, I know where you're entitled to receive some money. I'll help you get it. All you have to do is sign our agreement here saying that we get a third of it. If it's in Europe, it's over 50% that the heirship search firms will take. They then appear on behalf of the heirs that they represent. I told you about my telephone call to the nephew in California, telling him that he and his sister were each $250,000 richer, tax-free. If I had been representing an heirship search firm, I would have gotten about $160,000 for the 1 hour of work it took me to locate that nephew. That's not fair to the heirs, who under Oregon law are entitled to inherit. It is not what the legislature intended in writing Chapter 112 to define who are heirs. And I think you need to keep in mind that probate is a very regulated environment designed to deal with the fact that it is taking care of unsupervised assets, unsupervised money. My fees in probate have to be approved by the court. The personal representative's fees, the one who does the work administering the estate, are set by statute, and anything in excess of the statutory rate has to be approved by the court. The bill proposes that the fees of heirship search firms have to be approved by the court. Although we do set, the bill does propose a schedule of fees that in my view are more commensurate with the level of work required of these firms in order to locate heirs. Certainly there are cases when more than a usual customary amount of work is required to locate someone. In those cases, the bill allows the heirship search firm to go to court and get approval of the fee, just as a personal representative can go to court and get approval of a fee that exceeds the statutory schedule. But what is happening now is simply not fair to the heirs who are found through heirship search firms. Ninth point, change the starting time for recovery of escheat funds to the date of death. Right now, the statute in Chapter 116, 116.253, provides that that administrative process begins on the date of the decree of distribution. If the estate entirely escheats, that's where it would happen, or the order of escheat, if there's a partial escheat for an estate that goes through probate. The difficulty is that not all escheat funds reach the division of estate lands by one of those two routes. If there is a small estate, there is no order of escheat. There's only the filing of a small estate affidavit. Oregon law now specifically provides that for bank accounts under $25,000, if we have someone who dies and their only significant asset is a bank account, you know, they got a little bit of personal property, we're not going to file a probate for that. If they have a $5,000 bank account, I've got one open just like that right now, we file an affidavit with the bank saying that we're going to use this money the way the law requires. They deliver the money to us, and we put it in the escheat fund. We never have a court order of escheat. And so if an heir comes along a year from now, the question is, what's the starting date for his period to, his limited period of time to recover those funds? Since we've got funds coming in from so many sources, we cannot use a court order. A lot of these are not going through court. We need a date that is based upon the decedent's death. And the obvious date is the date of death to be the starting point, instead of the order that only occurs in some escheats, not in all. So that's the first change that we're seeking in that administrative process to deliver escheated funds back to the heirs when they show up late. The second change we're requesting is to shorten the period from 10 years to 3, after which the funds become irrevocably committed to the common school fund. And my philosophy behind that change, and this is entirely mine, I hope you'll keep in mind this is not a Division of State Lands bill, and I am not appearing here in my capacity as a Special Assistant Attorney General, and I'm not getting paid to write this bill or appear before you today. My philosophy behind that is this. The purpose of our statutes allowing heirs to inherit in the absence of a will by intestacy is to try to accomplish what the decedent wanted. That's the purpose of heirship, is to take the, to impose upon everyone the average situation, that they care about their family, even their family somewhat distant. If someone hasn't figured out within 3 years that dear old Cousin Joe is gone, they're not in the range of people that Cousin Joe cared about. And there's no reason to protect their interest past that period. You know, if the Christmas card is returned as undeliverable, you know, at least if they have that kind of relationship, they're going to find out you know, by Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever the next holiday is, or birthday, that they didn't get that card from Uncle Joe, or the card they sent to him was returned. 3 years is ample time for somebody the decedent might have cared about to realize the decedent's dead and come forward and claim that share. Usually we find them very quick. Very frankly, the administrative proceedings, so far as I'm aware, and I don't handle those, to recover escheated funds are pretty rare. One other change to that proceeding we want is this. Right now, the statute allows heirs to come forward within the 10-year period. And it allows them to come forward only if they were unaware of the probate. First, there's a simple error in there. Devisees should be able to come forward too. If a devisee was missing at the time of probate and the share of the devisee escheated, there's nothing in the law that allows the devisee to come forward. It focuses on heirs, whereas other parts of the law have broadened escheat to include devisees. So we want devisees to be able to do it. And second, we want heirs to be able to do it, or I suggest that they be able to do it, if there is new evidence that wasn't available at the time of the escheat order. And let me give you an example of that. We have an estate open right now, the Pettengill estate. Mr. Pettengill's mother abandoned him when he was a year old, and he was adopted by his maternal grandparents, so his mother became his sister in the eyes of the law. His mother then ran off with her new boyfriend and had three more children. In the mid-60s, Mom disappeared from the face of the earth. Her daughter, who was removed from the home on charges that she was being sexually abused by her two brothers and father, her daughter thinks her father murdered her mother. The two sons think that the mother ran off with a new boyfriend. Under Oregon law, we cannot presume the mother, who is now the sister in the eyes of the law because of the adoption, is dead. She's not. She wouldn't be 100 years old, which is the threshold for presuming that. We have no real basis for presuming she's dead. So she's the only heir. Okay? We have contact with the two nephews and a niece. In the eyes of the law, actually half-siblings, and biologically, who would be heirs if the mother predeceased our decedent. They know about the probate, but since they cannot prove that their mother is not living, they're not entitled to a share of the estate. They obviously don't want us to close the probate, because under the existing statute, they know about the probate, and even if the day after we close the probate, they get evidence that their mother has died, they could not bring that to us and say, see, we were the rightful heirs all along. So the bill would amend the statute, and this is a difficulty that I face time after time in closing probates. The statute would allow us to close that probate, move it over to the administrative process, allow those three children to come forward if over the appropriate period of time, 10 years or 3 years, they can prove that their mother predeceased their uncle. Point 12 is Section 1, which we've already discussed at some length. I've got in my testimony here, I'm not going to go through it, some examples of estates of fairly significant size that would be affected by this change, all of which involve substantial sums of money that could go to the common school fund that are going to, you know, what we commonly call laughing heirs, which are in fact more guilty heirs but willing to take the money in the sense that they feel guilty about it. They know they're not entitled to the money, but boy, they're going to take it. that I just don't think as a matter of public policy is appropriate. I've been writing wills for clients for over 30 years. And I'll tell you this, I just don't have clients that come forward that want to leave their estates to their cousins. I can't think of ever having had a client want to do that. Most clients, of course, have children, a spouse that they care about. For those who are single, unmarried, they may have siblings that they want their estate to go to, but very likely they're thinking about charities and want a chunk of it to go to charity. And to conform to the wishes of the average person, I think it more accurate to say the common school fund than to say cousins. If that's what intestacy is supposed to do, and I believe that that's what intestacy is supposed to do, we are no longer a community in which people stay in their hometown for their whole lives, know who their cousins are and their first cousins once removed. That's not the nature of society anymore. And just as airship law was changed in 1969, to recognize that fact, I think we can and should refine the change that was made in 1969 to better accomplish the purpose. An incidental effect of this certainly would be that the Common School Fund will grow at a much faster rate than it now grows. Point 13, codify and establish presumptions that will allow partial escheat estates to close. The way intestate shares are calculated is as follows. You find the highest generation of heirship. You're going to put aside siblings and children, spouses. The cases we're dealing with involve descendants of grandparents. Usually, and most of the cases I'm dealing with are somebody who died at age 80 or so. Okay? Usually, the highest generation that is surviving is a cousin. Sometimes the highest generation is a cousin once removed. In other words, the child of a deceased cousin. So let's assume that you have somebody who has two cousins surviving, and there were three cousins who died, two of whom left children. That estate would be divided into four parts, one part for each of the two cousins who survive, and one part for each of the two cousins who died, leaving issue. The two cousins who survived would each take a one-quarter share. For the two who survived leaving issue, the issue would take the share of their deceased parent. In other words, if one of them had three children, those children would each receive a 1/12 share, a third of a quarter. If one of them had one child, that child, the cousin once removed, would receive a 1/4 share. They take what's called by right of representation. The problem with that system is this, and I'm going to give you a specific example to define it. We have an estate in which the decedent, and this is not a cousin's case, this is siblings, so it would not be affected by Section 1 of the bill. The decedent's father was married twice. She had a half-brother by the second marriage. She had three half-siblings by the first marriage. The half-brother by the second marriage had died without children, so that's gone. one of her half-siblings had descendants. There are eight of them who are clearly heirs. No doubt about it. These eight people, cousins once removed, or excuse me, their great-nephews and nieces, are clearly heirs. She had a half-sister, however, for whom the last record is when she was married in Cheyenne, Wyoming in 1900. We have not a clue what happened to her. If she died without issue, that would resolve it. But we cannot presume she died under present Oregon law. We cannot presume she died without children. We don't know how many children she had, if she had any. We cannot calculate those other shares until we know how many children she had. So we can't really properly close that estate until we know what happened to the missing half-sister who got married in Cheyenne, Wyoming in 1900. What the bill would do would be two things. First, it would codify some existing court law that allows us to presume people have died. That's existing law. We're merely codifying it solely for purposes of determining the SG chair. Second, and this is new, but this is something, you know, we've been using administratively for the last 4 years since I dreamed it up in a case like this where we had to do something. We would assume that the missing half-sister had two children, and that would allow us to then calculate the shares of everyone so we could get this thing closed and determine the intestate of the SG chair. This problem is really a result of the 1969 code changes. Before 1969, we had a statute saying we would simply ignore someone like that missing half-sister, and we would ignore her descendants. That statute in 1969 was replaced with the current statute that says the shares of missing heirs, SG. But we simply didn't have the mechanism in the new 69 statute to determine what those shares are. This provides the mechanism to determine what those shares are. The last point in my outline, point 14, is to change the law to require better identification of collateral heirs in probate petitions. Right now, the law requires that a petition to open a probate provide a lot of information, including identification of heirs. And the statute says, as far as known. The result is, you don't have to say, you know, I'm a cousin. There may be 20 other cousins out there, but I don't know. You don't have to say if somebody you specifically know is missing, what you know about them. My experience practicing law, and I'm going to give you an example of this, is that attorneys are still in practice doing what the law allowed before 1969. They are ignoring people they can't readily find. An example in which I am very carefully going to not mention any names is an estate that I took over in the middle of administration 4 or 5 years ago. The Division of State Lands had initially had this estate. This was about a $500,000 estate. And Larry Larimer, who was very good at this, found an heir, somebody who lived in Oregon, and told him of the death of his cousin. It was a cousin. And he could not administer the estate, for a reason I'll explain shortly. But he could quickly point to another relative, another cousin, who didn't have his legal impediment. And That other cousin was appointed personal representative and administered the estate for a few months when they got a letter from an airship search firm notifying them that they had identified another cousin who was entitled to a one-third share of the estate. The first person had referred what became my client, the personal representative, to an attorney to handle the probate, and was extremely upset that that attorney had not bothered to sit down with them and tell them who might be heirs in this estate, because both of them knew about this cousin, and they just hadn't stopped to think, oh, that person's also an heir. The first person that the airship, or that the Larry Larimer had found, could not serve as personal representative because Oregon law prohibited circuit court judges at that time from serving as personal representative. He was extremely embarrassed and extremely upset at the manner in which this had been handled, and obviously very concerned about what people would think about it. And that's why that the first attorney got fired and I took over the estate. But that, in my experience, is very common practice among Oregon attorneys today. It's a carryover from pre-1969 practice. You got somebody in front of you that says, my uncle died, you know, I want to administer his estate, I guess I'm an heir. You don't spend a lot of time searching for somebody who's going to diminish your client's share. Frequently, you don't sit down with your client and explain to them, this is how the heirship search, how the heirship statutes work in Oregon. Who are the other relatives? Let's do a family tree and see who else might be entitled to an estate, to a share of this estate. That's not happening. And the bill would require that that happen. Because, again, the legislature has defined who's entitled to these estates through the heirship statutes, and this law should be honored. I could go into a couple other cases I've seen where people entitled to inherit have been excluded and never given notice. I had one estate that I opened, had to reopen 7 years after it was closed to get two grandchildren in who didn't get notice.
Right. Well, I think at this point, I think I'm going to want to redeem the time and get Jeanette Holman to come up and chat with us, and Lisa Joyce from DHS. If that's okay. And
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brady.
I just want to thank the witness for an incredible education today on how the statutes work and how the Common School Fund, you know, all I knew about it before today was those notices that appear periodically in the newspaper from the Department of State Lands. And I have a legal intern back there, Kevin, if you could raise your hand, who I'm sure just got a wonderful education today. Kevin's from the University of Oregon, so I wanted to thank you for walking us through this so clearly.
Which reminds me, Warren, did you bring the test?
The spot quiz. I served as legislative chair for the state planning administration section for two sessions and did a major revision of the claim statute and small state law the session before that. And I am accustomed to my testimony being the opportunity for people to be passing political notes back and forth up there and not paying much attention to me. And I was pleasantly surprised, frankly, at the level of attentiveness that I got from the committee today. I think this is important, and you know, my perception is the committee thinks it's important, and that's a good start.
Warren, you're probably talking about the House, because this is the Senate, and we are the more
that's
liberty
the problem.
Body.
Thank you,
thank you very much. Jeanette Holman and Lisa Joyce, do you want to come up at the same time? Yeah, okay. Good. I appreciate your patience here.
I'm a lot. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jeanette Holman from the Division of State Lands. I, too, appreciate Warren's great educational dissertation this morning. It's always an educational experience to talk to Warren. He's extremely...
I want to do something real quick, because you guys are actually here on 217, correct?
So no, for technical. 64. This is 64.
It is 64. Mm-hmm. Okay. Hang on just a second. Close the public hearing on 64. Open the public hearing on 217. This is your bill, right?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Close the public hearing on 217 and open a public hearing again on 64. I did that on purpose. It's called a tap-tap hearing.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Let me address Senate Bill 217 first. Senate Bill 217 was a requested bill from the Division of State Lands, and we submitted this early last spring before we went through a rulemaking process and before I had had the opportunity to have a lot of education from Warren. And the bill was intended to address some of the issues that Warren addresses in his bill, problems we had found in our administration of the estates. When we saw Warren's bill, we said, well, yours is much better than ours. Let's go with your bill. So unless there is a reason for 217 to stay open, we would request that you not do anything further on 217 and work with Warren's
bill. You never know when you'll have a bill.
I understand. I understand about titles.
All right. Well, so let's go back to 64 then. I'm just
okay.
What you have to say on that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Warren's already done a wonderful job of explaining why the Division of State Lands, who you think of as a natural resource agency, handles estates. And it's a fun area of our agency that a lot of people don't know a lot about. The monies do go to the Common School Fund, the proceeds of the estates. That's a constitutional directive. And what we see is that we do this as we represent that person. We serve as the personal representative for those persons in a trust capacity. The Division of State Lands supports Senate Bill 64 for two reasons. First, the bill is consistent with the mission of the agency to ensure a legacy for Oregonians and their public schools through sound stewardship of lands, wetlands, waterways, unclaimed property, estates, and the Common School Fund. The bill would directly benefit the school children of Oregon financially by the operation of the provisions in the bill that change the estate period and limit heirship. In addition, clarifications pertaining to the administration of estates by the division would allow us to carry out our responsibilities in a more efficient manner. It's our understanding that Mr. Darris has some amendments to the bill. We've looked at those amendments and would support them. In addition, we understand that the Department of Human Services has some concerns about the bill. We would like to work with them and with Warren to address their concerns and come back to you with an agreed-upon resolution.
Work product. Okay, good. Great.
I'm Lisa Joyce. I'm the Legislative Relations Manager for the Department of Human Services, and I'm sort of on the extreme end of Warren's testimony. I'm just here to state that we do have concerns about the bill, and we're looking forward to working with Division of State Lands and the bill's requester to find amendments that work for the Department of Human Services, whose responsibility is to administer estates of Medicaid clients.
Okay. Could you tell us just briefly what your concerns are in general?
Actually, I didn't come prepared because I haven't had a chance to review his proposed amendments. We're mostly concerned about any impediments to our ability to do the Medicaid estates administration and recoup those resources for the state.
Right. You ought to make sure that you perhaps are reimbursed as opposed to the Common School Fund.
Right. As required under federal law.
Right. Okay. Senator Ferriola.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question I have is, I know that Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs does conservatorships. Do they also do estates? And if there are estate issues in Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, how many other agencies are engaged in some mechanism of management of estates? And shouldn't they all be asked to come forward, review the bill, and potentially offer amendments?
It's a good. I mean, you have an answer to that as far as
Mr. Chair,
Veterans Affairs.
Senator Farrelly, Veterans Affairs does administer some estates, and they're right across the street from us. Haven't heard of any concerns, but certainly we can check with them.
Okay. Well, I think what we can do, too, is have our staff assist in maybe Mr. Sears. I don't know how long, 10 years, but that's an intern, but do some research to try to pull this all together, because the objective is to have a good comprehensive product that works for everyone. So, great. Anything else you wanted to say?
Mm-hmm.
No? All right. Thank you very much. Any questions by committee members? No? Warren, any last-minute thoughts you want to share with us? Anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on Senate Bill 64? If not, then I'm trusting then we'll have a work group on Senate Bill 64 involving the interested parties, and we coordinate that through Bill Joseph, I assume, and the judiciary staff. And hopefully we'll get the bill back fairly soon and can march through it.
All right. Thank you
very much. And we have one other administrative issue. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 64. We have an introduction of LC 1408, requires local government to refund or reverse appeal fee and transcript costs incurred by a person who successfully appeals a land use decision.
Chairman.
Senator Burry.
I move that we introduce LC 1408 as a judiciary committee bill.
All right. Senator Burdick moves that we introduce LC 1408 as a judiciary committee bill. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the introduction of LC 1408? If not, motion passes. Any other business before Senate Judiciary Committee? If not, we are now adjourned.
Now we can all go update our website.